that is, I don't know nothing, right? I tell my children all the time, deny everything and make counter accusations. Send them to general counsel's office. We've got a team of lawyers here at CU. They should make them make their salary, and you send them over to the general counsel's office. But you do not have to answer any questions about where students are.
Okay. We're going to pass over to the questions from all of you. Pero antes, I just want to point out to some resources. One of them being maybe what you were talking about with the ice. We have these little small printed ice cards. Algunos en inglés, algunos en español, right? Whichever language you want that you can carry. But it basically is outlining constitutional rights, like Alicia mentioned. Also sort of expressions if you don't know how to express that. So if you want to take those on your way out. Other resources, like I said, is Boulder Ayuda. There are also some business cards from Alicia. There's QR codes throughout the room. These are online links to some of the local on-campus and off-campus resources. Like some of the print items are also available online. We'll put the recording online as well. So, you know, please take advantage of those. But I think I wanna just pass along, spend the rest of the time para preguntas. Yes, you wanna start us off with a question? Una pregunta, sí. Como quiera.
No importa, hola. Somos bilingües.
Las dos.
And one of my questions is, what are the actual protection versus the aspirational protection? So being a nationality here in Boulder. And then you also mentioned the administrative executive orders. Did those take effect right away? And what's the point of view of the actual
I'll take the sanctuary city. All right. Are there real protections to a certain extent? Yes. But those protections are quite limited. Right. So living in a sanctuary city does not prevent ICE from carrying out an enforcement action in that sanctuary city. Who is going to stop them? No one is going to stop them. Certainly not our police officers. The ability to actually stop such an action is quite limited, but it is not, it's not without purpose to designate a city or an area a sanctuary city, because what it does is that it affects the way in which the officers and agents and other local officials operate. And that is important. Going back to the questions about the U visa, for example, if someone who is undocumented reports a crime in the city of Boulder, there's no absolute guarantee, of course, because a particular officer could be a jerk, but they're far less likely to report that person as undocumented to ICE because of the policies that we live in. So it is not without purpose to have that designation, but it is limited in what it can actually do. But it is important because it does create a greater sense of safety. And that greater sense of safety is not without merit. We do want people to be able to do things like report crimes, to renew their driver licenses, to, you know, request utilities or ask that a pothole in their street be fixed. Those are the everyday things that we do, and we don't want people to be afraid to ask for the help and services that they need to live their daily lives in a sanctuary jurisdiction.
Right, Boulder declared itself a sanctuary city the day after Trump was elected the first time. And what that meant was that we can't stop people from driving into Boulder, right? But what that means is that local law enforcement is no longer going to affirmatively reach out and contact immigration if things are happening. When I first got to Boulder 15 years ago, we would have an undocumented client who went on probation for a misdemeanor, and sometimes their probation officer would call ICE. That stopped after Boulder declared itself a sanctuary city, and that's important, right? But we can't actually physically prevent folks. I mean, when I was here on campus, some of our undocumented students went to the Regents asking for them to declare the campus a sanctuary campus. And then speaking with those students, I was like, you do understand that that's not going to prevent ICE from being able to just walk on campus. Boulder is super open. There's not like, it's just open. Anybody can walk onto campus, right? Like, we can't do that, but we can tell you that as a university, we weren't and we're not going to start like reaching out to ICE, right? Affirmatively to do any of that. With respect to the executive orders question, I mean, so some of the executive orders can take effect right away. I mean, just yesterday or the day before, Trump declared that all federal officials that were in DEI jobs or diversity, equity, and inclusion type jobs had to be put on leave immediately and sent home with no email access. Whoa, right? That happened immediately, right? He was able to implement that immediately. Now he's being a little smarter than the last time, right? He's saying, and then we're going to take some time to review, right, whether or not we're going to keep them on their jobs, which is good. For employment law purposes, right? They need to give themselves some like insulation from litigation. Last time around, he was super impetuous and I think had really bad advisors. I was like, doesn't he have a lawyer on staff? He's doing some stupid stuff that right away is gonna get stopped. This time he learned. He learned, right? He's got some smarter folks. He does have some lawyers on staff. So some of them can be implemented right away. Others, you know, it's all of this is like, you know, to the people who are really excited about all these executive orders, it feels like he's taking like swift and abrupt command, which is what they want him to do. It is absolutely going to take time to implement things like this. I mean, in terms of the mass deportations, right, that he's promised, going and finding, we have 11 million undocumented people who've been living in the United States, some of them for almost 30 years. Most of them have never had work authorization, never, right? They've never even had the opportunity to apply for it. Like, how you find them, right, is hard. With respect to like federal law enforcement, they don't have enough agents, right? I think what we will see over the next 4 years is state and local officials agreeing to help, right? So the federal government, we have a thing in the law called anti-commandeering, which means that the federal government cannot force the states to do their bidding. They can ask them to do it, right? They can encourage them to do it, but and they can give them some money in order to do it, right? But they can't make them do it. Right. I think one piece where I'm going to spend some time over the next 4 years, and any of you can as well, is talking to local law enforcement about not doing that. Please don't agree. Right. Like, talk to Mike Dougherty, our elected district attorney, who ran on a very progressive platform. But presumably, right, he doesn't want local law enforcement to be cooperating with the federal government. We should be talking. Send him a letter, call him up. Right? Call up our sheriff. Be like, I don't want you to sign. There's these things called 287G agreements that exist in the Immigration and Nationality Act, which are the mechanism by which the federal government can deputize state and local officials to do their bidding, to go out there and do enforcement actions. It ends up being, and they've been around for a long time. The first one was Sheriff Joe in Arizona. Remember that dude? Remember he was putting all the inmates in pink? He loved it, right? But it cost his jurisdiction, like those taxpayers paid thousands of dollars to agree, because the federal government doesn't pay for that entirely, right? The local jurisdiction ends up assuming lots of costs when it comes to those 287G agreements. So as a taxpayer, you have the right to call your representative and be like, A, I don't want you to target immigrants. B, I don't want to spend my money there. I don't want you to do those things, right? We do have some opportunities to get engaged if we're aware of these programs.
What was it called?
287G agreements. They're through the Immigration and Nationality Act. Hola, hola.
One question over here.
Yeah, this kind of goes hand in hand with the third question that we asked. But one thing I'm just realizing as you guys talk, first of all, super inspirational, and I appreciate you guys' little rhetoric around this conversation because I am so goddamn uninformed. But it feels as though the youth sphere is so uninformed, and with Trump coming to power, it feels as though the lack of education on a basic level surrounding undocumentation, DACA, all of that, it feels so overwhelming. And I guess the question I would ask is, how can I properly inform myself, and where is a good place to receive this unbiased information? Because I have just seen so many people around me agree agree with Trump's rhetoric, and it's so easy for them to just, I guess, it's just too easy for them to identify with what he's saying. So it just has such a reach for some reason. So I guess what can I do for myself to kind of confer with people that are so easy to agree with Trump's rhetoric about starting this conversation?
Well, you can come to things like this.
Absolutely.
You can come to law school and take my class.
Yeah.
We have a group on campus here called the Inspired Dreamers. They are a group of undocumented students. Get to know them, right? Come and listen to places and spaces and people who are talking about this thing in an extraordinarily courageous manner, right? It's one thing for me and Valicia to sit up here, you know, I'm safe. What are they going to do to me? I wish an ICE officer would come and ask me some questions, right? But a lot of people are not safe in that space. And so I try my best to not only to talk about it, but to be very clear that I am an ally here and I am your friend. And how, and you know, where can I put myself? Like Valise was like, we'll go talk to them. We sure will. Almost there. But how do we as people who are privileged, right, to have citizenship or have residency and be fairly safe, you know, stand up, but learn about it, talk about it in a very like clear way, but also listen. I think one of the things that I talk to my students about, you know, I teach the Immigration Defense Clinic, and we also have an immigration law podium class where students learn about the history. And I remember the teacher who was teaching immigration law came to talk to me, and she was like, you know, immigration is such a politically divisive subject. You know, how do you like remain neutral about it? I was like, oh, I'm sorry, I don't. People are self-selecting into my clinic. We are defending immigrants all day long. That's what we're doing, right? But that doesn't mean that we can't like consider both sides. We have to be able to see. I mean, what's been happening at the border for decades is complete and total chaos. That is not all right. We cannot accept that. And I remember when I started talking about it, there were some immigrant advocates. They were like, we want you to come talk about the border, but could you not say the word chaos? It's chaos. Chaos is not good for us, and it's certainly not good for the immigrants. Right? And anybody looking at that is like, oh, shit. And the migrant caravans, remember that? With like the hundreds of thousands. Everybody was like, oh, wait a second. But that looks really strange. So how do we address that? Like, how do we talk to people who might be inclined to disagree with us about the fact, I agree with you, we cannot just have, like, completely unregulated migration, right? What are the solutions to that? Like, I think we should spend a lot more time in diplomacy, talking to other countries, working with other countries to figure out ways to not force their folks to have to flee. Like, how do we do that? Like, most people, like the Venezuelan people, did not want to have to leave Venezuela. You know what they would have liked to do is just stay right there. Unfortunately, their government is in complete and total collapse. But we, America, we like complain about it, but we don't do anything on the front side to like help solve it. And I'm not saying to go in there. There have been many times where America goes in there, acts like the boss, and like they know what they're, and they tell everybody what to do. I'm not talking about that, right? But could we have some more like global conversations about how, you know, how do we help at least supplement or set up structures in countries like Guatemala and Honduras that have a lot of migration to the United States to help them find reasons to stay. Like, how do we do that? There's nonprofit organizations that are doing that, like just recognizing that it's best for people to stay in their country. That doesn't mean I'm isolationist or don't want anybody to come to America. I want them to be able to be safe and thriving in their own countries, right? So that they don't have to come here and get treated like shit in America. We don't treat them nicely here. Right? And so how do we like help do that? I would hope that there's going to be more diplomacy. I don't know if we're going to see that under the current administration, but you know, one can always hope.
And I have to add, so I've been to the border a couple of times recently, right? And one of the first times that I went to the border was with the breakout of the war in Ukraine. And so there are all these Ukrainians who were showing up in Tijuana, right? Do they speak a word of Spanish? No. At least for the caravans, they speak Spanish. And so they're able to function and operate and talk to people. And I showed up at the border and there are these masses of Ukrainians who are either speaking in Russian or in Ukrainian, whatever language somebody might be able to communicate in even a small amount with them. It was extraordinarily, how do I put this? So how many of you have ever crossed by foot at the border? Anybody? Okay, so there's kind of a field. So there's a line. There's an actual line. And depending on when you go and the time of day, that line could take you 3 hours on foot. Car, same thing, can easily take you 3 hours. And beside this line, there was an encampment of Ukrainians. And there were all these churches from all over California, because this was Tijuana, that had sent people over. There was a whole encampment of people beside the border, right? Right next to all the barbed wire. Encampment of people who fled war. And they were being treated so nicely by CBP officials. I was shocked to see how nicely they were being treated. Mexican police, who it started to rain, and they helped everyone to get to a bus shelter so they could get out of the rain. That is not the experience of Guatemalans, Hondurans, Salvadorans who show up at the border. Oh, definitely not Haitians who show up at the border. It's extraordinary. And it was chaos, nonetheless. And you know what happened? We created United for Ukraine. What does that mean? Is that when we have the will to do so, we will. Because Uniting for Ukraine permitted people to seek entry into the United States when they were taking shelter in Poland or in Tijuana. They were able to do so. And it dissipated the chaos. People were no longer showing up at the border in Tijuana. I don't speak Ukrainian or Russian. I was still there helping people. Humanitarian parole. Repeat. Humanitarian parole. That's what I was doing in the work. Mass chaos. We can change things, but we choose not. So what do? Advocate with your congresspeople. Right now, our own congresspeople, they need to hear voices that say, we do not support these anti-immigrant policies, and we know that we can, in fact, take action. Look at Uniting for Ukraine.
I just want to add one comment, too, for students or any of us who are interested in, like, maybe learning a little bit more about the experience. We see you, the CU Boulder Buffs One Read is about Solito. It is a memoir about, you know, a Central American child migrant coming to the United States. So that's one opportunity to connect with community and to also keep discussing these topics throughout the year. And so that would be one. And then also, if you go on the QR code, there is a link to the undocumented student resources on campus that also sometimes is trainings, if that's something that's interesting. Yes, for the question.
I'm apparently some of us here who work for UBSD, and we're helping students apply to college. And a lot of the questions I'm getting is, can I trust FAFSA?
So undocumented students, including those who have DACA, are not eligible to receive federal financial aid. So they can't apply for the FAFSA if they're undocumented. There's other ways to get them aid, and CU has figured that out. In my opinion, the leader here, there's two real leaders in Colorado. That's CSU up in Fort Collins, Colorado State, and Metro State in Denver is very good at directing parents and families to institutional aid that is available to them, even if they don't have access to the FAFSA.
CAFSA,
yeah. So they fill out the Colorado.
And they trust them.
Yes.
And trust
them. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Another resource, Dreamers Roadmap.
Yeah.
So that's a good resource for scholarships and alternative funding.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we did here, we've done a couple things. So states do have some ways to support undocumented residents that live within their borders. One of them, two big things happened in Colorado in 2013. One, we passed a law that allowed undocumented residents of Colorado to get access to a driver's license, right? And that makes sense in lots of ways, right? States are able to decide, like, safety on their roads. That's something that we care about. And it's much safer to have people who have passed the driver's test, right, and have insurance. And so undocumented people can get a driver's license in the state of Colorado. We can't do anything about their immigration status, but we can get them a driver's license. The other thing we did that same year was pass the asset bill, which allowed undocumented high school graduates to have access to in-state tuition if they met the residency requirements, which was huge, right? That really changed, because for years, Colorado had been treating undocumented students, even if they lived in Colorado almost their whole life, they were treating them like international students, which made it like just impossible for them financially, especially if they're not eligible for federal financial aid. So allowing them access to in-state tuition really exploded our numbers in colleges, right? That was a big deal.
We see two questions, so I'm going to start with you in the back, and then I'll.
So I work with public community groups outside on private property. Most of the interaction that I spent was around entering the buildings and warrants. Going outside, getting paid in about private property, with the fence, and the money.
Excellent question. It's still private property, and it doesn't matter if it is 200 acres and cattle and a teeny tiny little fence. It's still private property, and it must still have a warrant.
Or permission.
Or permission. So don't grab it. Will they enter anyway? They could. Absolutely, they could. And that is an opportunity to act as a bystander, record the interaction, take the information, and then hand that to a lawyer.
ICE has been sued. ICE likes to play hard. They've got a little bit of a reputation as sort of the rogue law enforcement, and they like to come at it. And so there was the famous lawsuit was that they came with a warrant. The family was so brave. They were like, we want to see the warrant. And they responded very professionally. It was like, we've got a warrant up your ASS, is what they said. They were caught on tape with that. And ICE had to pay millions of dollars in damages to the undocumented immigrants. So they hopefully will learn from situation. They're not, they can't do things like that. And so there has been successful litigation that they are well aware of, and that's served, you know, at times to check their behavior.
Private property,
Mama. Yeah.
Any other questions?
For resources that they want to start using PBS, that's our own public resource that the United States doesn't fund anymore, but it's for us. And I think like they give out good news for whatever the situation is.
Thank you.
Did everybody hear that? It was about PBS and local broadcasting.
Public broadcasting.
Or public.
I have a follow up question for the FAFSA. What about if the parents aren't documented, but their child is documented? Is FAFSA trustworthy there because you are giving your parents permission to that? So, wouldn't that be that?
So right now there is no information sharing between the Department of Education and Immigration Enforcement, just like there's no information sharing between the IRS and Immigration Enforcement. That is like the favorite thing for IRS. Undocumented people have been paying taxes in the United States for decades, and the IRS loves it. They're delighted to take information. If you don't have a social security number, they are happy to issue what's called an individual taxpayer ID number, which is an ITIN, which is also 9 digits. And that allows undocumented people to pay taxes. But unable to get that, IRS does not share with USCIS or with immigration, and neither does the Department of Education with respect to the FAFSA. Some people are still like too afraid, like all we can do is tell them that and encourage them to do that. But yes, a lot of citizen children are afraid to disclose the names and information of their undocumented parents. I understand that, but right now there's no information sharing. Whether or not that could change over the next 4 years is something that remains to be seen.
But do not give false information on a FAFSA application, even if it is for the purpose of protecting undocumented parents.
Do you anticipate over the next 4 years that there could be real action towards change of birth, right? Citizenship status of children who have one or more immigrant parents?
They're certainly trying. That was the first sort of thing that they did. That was met with immediate litigation, in my opinion. I don't know. I'm not always right. I don't think it's going to go anywhere. The 14th Amendment is very clear that all persons born or naturalized in the United States, so physically in the United States, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are U.S. citizens. Him just being like, no, he's not, he's just the president, right? And he has a lot of power, but he can't just change the Constitution like that. So the executive order that he just issued, I think, is in clear violation of the 14th Amendment. In order to change the Constitution, you have to go through a process. You get a two-thirds majority in Congress, and then you need two-thirds of the states to ratify it. Maybe he can get that done, but that's a much more complicated process, which he chose not to do. Maybe he'll try to get it down that way, but I don't think it's going to go far in court. But it is certainly something that, you know, this is where I do now get partisan, where the Republican Party has wanted to do that for quite some time. But it's been in our laws for over, I mean, it's longer than just 125 years ago, we made it a law, right? But before that, we had birthright citizenship here in the United States and England and lots of other places. There is birthright citizenship, and it's just been what's happened for a long time. It'd be very hard to overturn. Good night.
Última pregunta, yeah, last question.
Well, wouldn't that be fun, though? Right. So let's take this out, right? Because but now we're playing logic games. So you're not subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So are you not subject to the jurisdiction of the immigration court? So you're not subject.
So that means they can't deport you. I mean, they can't.
Let's
try.
You really. This is not a game you want to play. Right, not subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Does that mean that I can commit crimes with impunity in the United States because I am not subject to the jurisdiction thereof? This is a dangerous game that they're trying to play.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very clear that even undocumented people who live here have no right are absolutely subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. We charge undocumented people with crimes, you know, in the rare instances that they commit them. Right. They're subject to our jurisdiction in a whole array of ways, and I think they're going to try to go there, and I think that's what they're saying, right? And it's another way for the administration to other them, as if they're not like here. They're here physically, but they're not really here, right? Good question.
Últimas palabras. Any final words before we end for today?
I'm so grateful to all of you for coming and listening and for being so engaged. Thank you. And thank you, Tracy, for hosting us.